As you know, this week's lecture is on banksterism and foreign policy, and so my comments will be mostly around the essay by Rothbard on Wall Street, banks, and American foreign policy, which is a huge topic, and a great deal more research and writing needs to be done on this. I'm just rereading the essay. I got several ideas myself for research and writing projects that I think are worthwhile, and I'll mention them in the course of the class. And so the first point that Rothbard makes is that he makes the case that bankers are inherently statists under a fractional reserve banking system, which is pretty much what the world has now these days. And he talks about investment bankers, and these are the big banks, for example, the big Wall Street investment banks that pool huge amounts of money to finance major corporate endeavors, among other things. And investment banking began almost at the beginning of the American Republic, and it existed in Europe before that. But originally, it was just the purpose was just that, to pool capital by investors to finance the expansion of businesses. And so as world trade expanded and as economies grew, this was a quintessential capitalistic function, investment banking, a key component of capital markets. However, the investment bankers almost immediately got into the business of selling government bonds for the government and buying government bonds. And so they became attached to the government. It was in their interest. It became in their interest to have an ever-growing government and ever-increasing tax revenues of the government to make sure that their business was sustained, their business of buying and selling government bonds. And so they became joined at the hip, so to speak, with the state. So that investment bankers have always been, first and foremost, statists. That's why in the United States, it seems like it has never been the case, I'm sure, that the United States Treasury Secretary has not been the former head of Goldman Sachs. It seems like every time the new president is elected and he needs to appoint a U.S. Treasury Secretary, it's the guy who runs Goldman Sachs. Or the second in command, because the first in command is about to retire, or something like that. And so it's the Wall Street investment bankers that are joined at the hip with the government. And also just the commercial banking business in general, because of fractional reserve banking, because banks have this tendency to overextend themselves, to take on too much risk because they're allowed to. If the government tells them they only need to keep 5% of their money in reserve and can lend out 20 times what they have in reserve, they will do their best to lend out every penny they can, because that's how they make their money, so they make their profit, and then some. And then when they take on too much risk and they fail, the government guarantees their failures and bails them out, as we all learned in great detail over the past 5 or 6 years with the multi-trillion-dollar bailouts of the banking system. And so that's the first point he makes. And, of course, the first investment banker in America was a man named Jay Cook. It's spelled K-O-O-C-O-O-K-E, rather. And so Rothbard talks about how by the time you get to the late 19th century in America, the bankers had pretty much infiltrated and essentially taken over the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party in the 19th century started out as the party of Jefferson, the party of Andrew Jackson, who was opposed to central banking, the party of laissez-faire for the most part. Not every single Democrat, but by and large, the Democratic Party was the libertarian party of the 19th century. But it wasn't, of course, any perfect utopia. Nothing on earth is. But then that changed dramatically beginning at the very end of the 19th century, and the infiltration of the Democratic Party by banksters had a lot to do with that. And it was the bankers and force the people whose businesses they funded, American manufacturing corporations in particular, who really pushed for a change in American foreign policy. Because up until the American Civil War in the 1860s, American foreign policy, for the most part, not exclusively, but for the most part, followed the dictates or the dogma of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, which was commercial relationships with all nations, entangling alliances with none. That changed after the American Civil War, where in decades past, as soon as the Civil War was over, there was all sorts of agitation to invade England because England had traded with the southern states during the war. President Ulysses S. Grant wanted to invade Santo Domingo as soon as the Civil War was over, and he became president after the war. And then, of course, by the time we get to the 1880s and 1890s, we have the Spanish-American War and with the American invasion of Cuba and the Philippines. And so we had gone toward imperialism. And there's a famous essay by William Graham Sumner. The title, I think, is The Conquest of the United States by Spain. It's about the Spanish-American War in the late 19th century, and it's about how, by invading the parts of the Spanish Empire, Philippines, Cuba, and so forth, the United States had become Spain. It had become an empire, whereas it was a constitutional republic previously, but this was the breaking point. And Rothbard, of course, documents how the banksters had a big role to play in the transformation of America from a constitutional republic to an empire. And they pushed for imperialism. Basically, first they wanted to take over Latin American markets from England and Germany. Germany and England had, corporations from Germany and England had been doing a lot of business and had sort of set up shop in much of Latin America. And so the idea was to send the U.S. military there to essentially upset things there and kick out the Germans and the British to the best of their ability for the benefit of American corporations and the bankers who funded them and who profited from them. And so the Marines were sent into Nicaragua, Santo Domingo, Cuba, at this period of history, to do just that. And I think I might have mentioned in this class last week or the week before a famous essay called War is a Racket by General Smedley Butler, who was a famous, he's said to be the most highly decorated American Marine in American history. And after being in the Marine Corps and being a general in the Marine Corps for all of these years of his life, he wrote this book, War is a Racket, which is online, explaining how all of these escapades that he participated in such as the places that I just mentioned, were really all about making money for some corporations and some banksters and had nothing whatsoever to do with defending America or Americans from any foreign threats. And so Rothbard has sort of entertainingly talks about how, and of course he talks about how the two big corporate empires that began in the 19th century and exist to this day were the ones started by J.P. Morgan and his associates, and then really sort of a rival gang, the Rockefeller gang, Rockefeller Orbit. And so American presidents and their appointees for many, many years, for generations, have been pretty much controlled under the thumbs of one or the other of these very wealthy Wall Street-centered empires, the Morgan Empire or the Rockefeller Empire. And even when William McKinley, who was president in the late 19th century, was assassinated by a lone nut, as Rothbard says. He sort of mocks the idea that every time there's an assassination, whether it's John F. Kennedy or William McKinley, it's always a lone nut. You know, nobody ever had anything else to do with it but some individual crazy person. And it just so happened that Teddy Roosevelt then became president, and he was a lifelong Morgan man, as Rothbard calls it. And so he had been a supporter, and his career had been bankrolled by the Morgan Empire for many years, and he became president. What a surprise. And one of the things Teddy Roosevelt is known for as president is he was a so-called trust buster. And I would recommend, as far as books on Teddy Roosevelt, I would recommend the book Bully Boy by Jim Powell. Jim Powell is the author of quite a few biographies. He's very well-schooled in the Austrian School of Economics, a good researcher. He wrote another excellent book on FDR called FDR's Folly that I would also recommend, but Bully Boy is his book on TR, Teddy Roosevelt. And Teddy Roosevelt is the neocons' favorite president, the so-called neoconservatives in America. They always say that he was their favorite president. Bill Clinton also said that Teddy Roosevelt was his favorite Republican president, of all the Republican presidents, even more so than Abe Lincoln. And so one of the things that Teddy Roosevelt did was to launch antitrust lawsuits, federal antitrust lawsuits against Standard Oil, which was John D. Rockefeller's company. And so you had these two great rivals, these two great captains of industry, two great banksters. You have the Morgan Empire. Their man becomes president, and one of the first things he does is to launch a federal lawsuit against Standard Oil Company, which was part of the opposing empire, the opposing economic empire of the Rockefeller family. And so the Standard Oil lawsuit was began in the year 1895, and it dragged on and was not concluded until the year 1911. So you had the 16 years in which the executives of Standard Oil were harassed by the government and had to go in and out of court in an endless, seemingly endless appearances, court appearances. There must have been many millions of pages of legal documents that went through there. And so the end result of it, though, was that the Standard Oil Company was broken up by the federal government, and they had to create Standard Oil of New Jersey, Standard Oil of Ohio, and they were accused of monopolizing the oil industry, which was really a ridiculous joke from an economic perspective. And if you really want to learn about the Standard Oil case, read what Dominic Armentano has to say about it in his book Antitrust and Monopoly. And so basically what you would learn if you looked at it was that the Standard Oil Company of John D. Rockefeller made its money and made Rockefeller the richest man or one of the richest men in the world during his time by constantly dropping the price of refined petroleum for decade after decade. It became cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And they invented many, many new products. They invented gasoline and things like that out of oil residue. And so as a result, the masses could have heat and light at night with refined with kerosene lamps, which they could never be had before. And this was before electricity, of course. Standard Oil Company was founded in the year 1866, right after the American Civil War was over. And so if you look at the actual history of what Standard Oil was doing, they weren't monopolizing anything. And even when the government broke them up in the year 1911, they still had over 300 competitors, including quite a few giant corporations like Sun Oil Company, which became Sunoco, the Pure Oil Company, and quite a few others. And so they never achieved anything like a monopoly. And even it was so competitive that during that time, their market share went from over 80% to about 11% during the time of this lawsuit. And so they were losing, and they had been losing market share because of the fierce competition. So the idea that it was a monopoly is absurd and ridiculous. The success went, though, to the Morgan machine, because they tied up Standard Oil's executives. It forced them to pay endless attention to this lawsuit instead of paying more and more attention to their business. And that has always been the purpose of antitrust. It has always been an anti-competitive tool. It has always been a protectionist tool. And I've written quite a bit on this over the years myself. One of my old articles that has been very widely cited is called The Origins of Antitrust, an Interest Group Perspective, and it's online, somewhere. If you just, I think I mentioned it last week also, or the week before, and it shows how all of the original companies that were accused of being monopolies in the late 19th century worked. They were super competitive. Okay, so that was the first one of the first things that Teddy Roosevelt did, and then his successor, President Taft, happened to be a Rockefeller man. And so they took their revenge. The Rockefeller machine had their man in the White House. And so they took their revenge by launching antitrust lawsuits against U.S. Steel and International Harvester, which were part of the Morgan orbit, the Morgan Empire. And so these were the origins of antitrust law in America. It was sort of a petty rent-seeking battle between the Morgan Empire and the Rockefeller Empire, and they used the antitrust laws to try to thwart competition by their big rivals. Then when Woodrow Wilson came in as president in the year 1913, he was inaugurated in early 1913, he won the 1912 election, he was a Morgan man. So his career had been financed, his political career, by the Morgan Empire. And as Rothbard says, World War I, which Wilson got America into, was a godsend to the Morgan Empire because many of its businesses had been floundering and they weren't very profitable at all, especially their iron and steel businesses. It was fiercely competitive. The Russians were doing better and better in the steel industry. The British had a very well-developed steel industry. And the Morgans, with U.S. Steel and other companies, were having a tough time competing. But they were rescued with massive contracts for iron and steel and munitions of all sorts for the European War. Even before the Americans got into the European War, they were selling war bonds with their bankster business, and they were selling munitions with their manufacturing business. And so they did very well when Wilson, their man in the White House, got the U.S. involved in World War I. It really was a godsend, a financial godsend for Morgan Empire. For example, the average profit in the steel industry went from 7.4% in 1914, this was long before the U.S. entered the war, to 28.7% in 1917. That was the year on the eve of American entry into World War I. And so they had been financing the war machines in Europe by the British and the French and doing very well with government contracts and selling war bonds also once the Americans entered the war. And so that was very profitable for them. And so the Morgan Empire also financed a massive propaganda campaign to get the United States into World War I. They formed something called the National Security League, and they paid various academics and journalists to write articles and books and pamphlets of all sorts and to give speeches in favor of U.S. entry into World War I. And, of course, World War I was a colossal catastrophe for the entire world. And Rothbard makes the point that is also made in the book Bully Boy by Jim Powell that had the United States not entered World War I, then the European powers would have eventually resolved their problems on their own. There would have been an armistice. There would have been something different than the Versailles Treaty that ended World War I. And what happened, though, with the Versailles Treaty being so punitive for the Germans, it pretty much strengthened the hand, eventually, of the Nazis, and the outcome of World War I also strengthened the hand of the communists in Russia. And so we ended up strengthening the communists in Russia and their fellow socialists, the National Socialists in Germany. And, of course, the Russian socialists called themselves International Socialists, and the German socialists of the time called themselves National Socialists, but they were all socialists. And so World War I, the way it turned out, thanks in large part to the U.S. entry, strengthened the hand of socialism worldwide. But it enabled the banksters to make an awful lot of money, the Morgan orbit especially. And the Fed, of course, the Fed, the creation of the Fed was the culmination of a long crusade funded by the Rockefeller Empire and the Morgan Empire. They funded many of the most prominent economists of the day to write articles and books and reports in favor of the central bank. And they, of course, they eventually succeeded in the year 1913. And the Fed made a U.S. entry into World War I possible. The Fed financed about a fourth of the U.S. Expense of World War I. And the money supply doubled in the United States between in just a couple of years, in just 2 years, once the United States entered World War I. And also the price level. The price level about doubled in the United States as a result of that. And so this was really the doing of the Morgan Empire and the Rockefeller Empire. American entry into World War One, as Rothbard says, I don't see how it's hard to disagree with him that this decision of the American government to enter World War One was probably the worst decision politically that was made in the entire 20th century. What a catastrophe it created. And then after the war was over, the Morgan Empire then created the Council on Foreign Relations. And it eventually became dominated by the Rockefellers, even though the Morgans created it. It became dominated by the Rockefellers. And so ever since the days right after World War One, the Council on Foreign Relations has been promoting imperialism. Imperialism and the use of American military force for the benefit of the banksters and their corporate partners in manufacturing and elsewhere. And so the Rockefellers, by the time we get to the 1930s, the Rockefellers wanted a war with Japan because they wanted to eliminate competition in the petroleum business, especially in Asia. And Japan was doing very well. Even though Japan did not have any oil itself, it was doing very well in the transportation of oil all around Asia and dominating Asia. And of course, the Japanese were warlike also, and they were invading countries in Asia to take over their oil resources. Well, the Rockefeller Empire, and John D. is long gone at this point, wanted a war with Japan, and they got it. The Morgans, on the other hand, were closely linked business-wise with England and France, and so they wanted a war in Europe. And so World War II, as Rothbard says, was consequently a matter of the Rockefellers getting what they wanted, war with Japan, and the Morgan Empire getting what it wanted, war with Germany in Europe. Also established, years later, by the time you get to the 1970s, you got the Trilateral Commission established by the Rockefeller Empire and the National Security Council as part of the United States government. And so if you look at some of the mischief that they engaged in, one of the things that happened that the so-called National Security Council was involved in was having the CIA overthrow the government of Iran in the early 1950s and put in power a puppet of the Americans, which was the Shah. And so and as a result of this, American oil companies got 40% of the Iranian oil. The British, who had already been there, were not totally kicked out, but their share of Iranian oil went from 80% to 40%, and I guess the Iranians themselves got to keep the other 20%. Of Iranian oil. And so that was the end result. In return for taking over a large chunk of the Iranian oil business, the American government kept the Shah in power as a dictator. And of course, he was a hated dictator, and that of course led to the overthrow of the Shah in the 1970s. And many of the Iranians, to this day, as you can imagine, despise the U.S. government, as they should, for doing that. And then President Eisenhower didn't have a sterling record either. He had the CIA invade Guatemala after the government of Guatemala nationalized the National Fruit Company, which was an American company. And so they sent the Marines in and the CIA to overthrow the government of Guatemala. And then President Kennedy had the CIA murder the president of South Vietnam, Diem. It was the very last foreign policy move he made as president. And for similar reasons, Nixon comes along, and these presidents were all either a part of the Morgan orbit or the Rockefeller orbit. Nixon overthrows the Chilean government with the help of the CIA because United States firms controlled about 80% of the Chilean copper industry. And copper was the number one export of the country of Chile. And so the CIA went down and orchestrated the overthrow of Allende, the Chilean government. Then when President Carter comes around, he paid millions of dollars to the Panama government as a bailout of the Panamanian government as part of the Panama Canal Treaty. Well, what this was really a bailout of the big Wall Street banks that had lent a lot of money to the government of Panama, and then the government of Panama could not pay because a lot of the money was stolen or squandered. And so the bailout was really a bailout of the Wall Street banks, courtesy of the American taxpayers. And then during the 1980s, there was a third world bailout. There was a bailout of the so-called third world countries. By the World Bank, the IMF, the U.S. government, many billions of dollars. But this was really a bailout, primarily of the Wall Street banksters, because they had lent all this money to these third world dictators, and the third world dictators did what third world dictators do. They stole a lot of the money, put a lot of it into Swiss bank accounts, and of course, being government-dominated countries, the government just squandered the money, and this money was like poured down into a black hole, as it always is with foreign aid or foreign loans to such countries. And so the big, massive, multi-billion-dollar third world bailout of the 1980s was really a bailout of the Wall Street banksters who had lent all this money. And they lent the money at a very high rates of interest because they said, well, there's a lot of risk. These are shaky third world governments and economies. But, of course, there was always sort of a wink-wink there in that there was an implicit guarantee, if you will, that the U.S. government would do whatever it would take to bail out these governments if they could not pay off the loans, either through pressuring the World Bank and IMF or the U.S. taxpayers or the Fed, for that matter. And so the Fed was not only instrumental in funding World War I, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, but all the other wars, the Korean War, the Vietnamese War, and every other war. And it's so instrumental in doing so because it really hides or disguises the cost of war. As Ludwig von Mises once wrote, that war weariness would set in much faster if wars were financed by taxes rather than by the printing of money, and which causes price inflation and a hidden tax. You can imagine today what American taxpayers would say if the government said, well, we're planning on invading Iran and maybe Syria, and it's going to cost a lot of money, so each family is going to be sent a $25,000 tax bill as your contribution to the war. There would be a very big anti-war movement in America immediately. But if this is financed largely by the Fed's legalized counterfeiting operation, well then the government will do what it always does, and when the prices do go up, it'll blame the price inflation on greedy capitalists and never blaming it on the Fed. And so that's I think that's the way it works. And so these are my comments on Rothbard's long essay, and you can read it as well as I can. I think it's a great opportunity for anyone taking this course to sit down and read this essay, because Rothbard did a tremendous amount of digging around to find out who the names are, who the characters are that actually run the show when we talk about mercantilism or neo-mercantilism and this corrupt relationship between bank and state. It's one thing to theorize about it, but it's another thing to do the hard work in digging into the actual history of who the individuals were and are. And so next week in the class, I think what I'm going to do is I just got today a copy of David Stockman's new book on the history of American banksterism. As much of what it is, and I'm going to read as much of it as I can. I'll probably finish it by next week, and so I think it will be of the most benefit to the class if I sort of devote next week's class to sort of an extended review of Stockman's book, at least the parts of it that do seem to provide a great deal of detail about banksterism today, especially the current economic crisis. And I did put some articles on the syllabus for next week on that, but that's what I'm planning on doing. I just got the book in the mail today, and I've started reading it, and I'll have it finished by the next class. And just from what I've seen already, it seems like a great complement to the Rothbard essay on Wall Street banks and the American foreign policy, because he does talk about all the wars financed by the Fed. He does talk about the awfully corrupt relationship between the Wall Street banks and the Fed, and how the Fed has pretty much become a Fedocracy in America, and for the benefit primarily of the 1%ers, as they're called, most of whom work and reside on Wall Street. And so that's what we'll do next week. And I think that's about all I'm going to have to say for tonight. I wanted to give an overview of some of my commentary on Rothbard's great essay, and I'll be glad to do whatever I can to answer whatever questions people have. The last couple of weeks, you've had great questions. And it's The Great Deformation is the title of the book. So that's why I put for next week, I had Danny Sanchez add to my reading list Lou Rockwell's early review of this book. See, Cam is doing his usual good job of putting all these links in on the reading list there, on the chat. So feel free if you have some questions. I'll do what I can to answer whatever questions you have. Let's see, Phil Bob is asking, any books in the spirit of Rothbard's Wall Street Foreign Policy? Well, I would recommend looking into the books written by Robert Hicks. He's written several, and of course his most famous book is Crisis and Leviathan, and there is some of that, and it is very Rothbardian in spirit, and so that's his most famous book. If you've not read Crisis and Leviathan, and Murray Rothbard himself loved that book. He thought it was a great piece of scholarship. And so I would start with that, but Bob Hicks' more recent books also, look at them. Look them over, look at the table of contents on Amazon if you want, and I would recommend all of them. Let's see, is Obama a Rockefeller or a Morgan man? Well, if he's smart, he's probably a little bit of both. I think he is a little bit of both. They raise money from, the big Wall Street banksters play both sides of the fence. They always give money to both parties to hedge their bets. And so I would guess he's both.
Let's
Yeah, Rob asks, are Krugman's attacks on Stockman's book a good sign that Stockman is on target? Absolutely. That's absolutely true. Whenever you get a phony propagandist for the state like Paul Krugman upset in writing numerous blogs calling David Stockman an old man, you know, how about that? You call him a cranky old man. Now, isn't that ageism? You know, the New York Times and the leftists there are always so sensitive about language and so forth. But when it comes to someone like David Stockman, you can call him a crazy old man in the pages of the New York Times. You know you're doing the right thing if the right people are criticizing you. Let's see, looking for more questions here. I don't know about Obama's signing statement on the Military Appropriations Act. I don't know what he said, so I try not to keep up with everything Obama says. It makes me sick. So I'm afraid I can't answer that one. Let's see, Helen M. is asking, how does the current U.S. military size compare to that of the U.S. in World War I and II as relates to the budget? Well, during wartime, the budget, as a percentage of budget, always skyrocketed. Sort of historically, peacetime defense budget during the Cold War in the United States was around 4 to 5%, something like of the GDP. Not of the budget, but of GDP, but in wartime it spikes up to much more than that, so I'm not sure what the point is of the question actually. Is it likely that the massive U.S. military weaponry will be used only in training? Well, I think that's unlikely. We have military bases in something like 150 countries around the world, the whole globe. There was someone on one of the blogs, probably Lou Rockwell, there was a map that somebody put of U.S. military presence in the Persian Gulf area. And we have Iran totally surrounded with all sorts of military installations. And so if you want to know who the aggressor is in that part of the world, it's the U.S. military. And of course, everywhere the U.S. military plants itself like this, there are lots of people who resent the heck out of it, and some of them become terrorists because they resent it so much. I hear there's Michael saying, sending our troops to promote freedom. Well, that's always the disguise, isn't it? And all these examples that Rothbard gives of the Marines invading Guatemala and things like that, the government can't say, we took several million dollars in campaign contributions from the United Fruit Company and we owe them a favor, so we're going to kick out the government of Guatemala for their fragmentation. No, they have to say, we're spreading freedom around the world and we want the people of Guatemala to be as free as Americans. And a big part of that is the mythology of Abraham Lincoln. Obama, in his United Nations speech last September and in his first inaugural address, stated the same old party line that both parties have stated in defense of foreign military interventionism for at least the past 100 years. And they say that when Abe Lincoln paraphrased the Declaration of Independence in the Gettysburg Address and spouted the words, all men are created equal, they say he meant all men everywhere, all over the world, not just in America. And created equal means they deserve equal freedom. And so this idea has been used, this perversion of the words of the Declaration of Independence, first by Lincoln and then by generations of American imperialists, has been used as the justification to invade country after country, war after war, for economic reasons, for reasons of economic plunder, on the behalf of the banksters and their manufacturing associates, but in the name of freedom. So we invaded the Philippines and murdered more than 400,000 Filipinos so that they could be free, so we were told. The same is true with Iraq and Afghanistan, the occupation of Afghanistan and today's world, and all these other military interventions, the Vietnam War, you name it. But that's part of the ideology. So there is this ideology of spreading freedom around the globe. But if you follow the money, you find out that the ideology is false. We're not spreading freedom around the world. We're making enemies. Let's see. Let me catch up to some of the questions here. Malcolm says, how did the U.S. Central Bank become independent in 1951? Well, it isn't that it never has been independent of politics. The president still appoints the chairman of the Fed, and Congress has to, or the Senate has to okay it. And so whoever is the chairman has to have the approval beforehand of the Senate, and the president, of course, has the appointment power. And so it's a myth that the Central Bank is independent, even though it has changed the way it does business on several occasions. President Eisenhower's farewell speech on the military-industrial complex, it's on the web if you go on YouTube and look for Eisenhower's farewell speech, his warning about the military-industrial complex. Well, he was a tool of the military-industrial complex, so I guess he must have felt guilty about it on his last day in office, and so he warned about it during his farewell speech. And I think the American, I would call it the military-industrial congressional complex, has become much larger and much more gargantuan than Eisenhower could ever have imagined himself. Oh yes, as Audrey asked, I believe the U.S. is the aggressor with Iran. Of course, the U.S. is the aggressor. Iran does not threaten Americans at all. They have no capability whatsoever of harming a single American, and they have no capability of harming anyone in Israel either. Israel has hundreds of nuclear missiles. Iran has none. And the only reason the Iranians want to develop a nuclear program is to defend themselves against the Americans, and they see what's going on around the world. And they of course would understand that it would be total suicide to pick a war with the United States. They could be incinerated, the whole country could be incinerated by our nuclear bombs in a couple of minutes. And so all of the agitation and all of the aggression is by the U.S. I wouldn't say the U.S., I would say the neoconservatives, which are in both parties. Obama has carried forward the neoconservative foreign policy of Bush. And so, yes, the Iranians pose no threat whatsoever, any more than the Iraqis did in the early 90s or in the second Persian Gulf War. They never threatened anybody in America. There's a question about war financing. Well, yes, that is the methods of war financing is taxation, inflation, borrowing, or conscription. And the conscription involves conscripting factories as well as individuals. Conscription meaning the draft. In World War I and World War II, the U.S. government took and nationalized some industries. They nationalized the entire railroad industry during World War I. They also nationalized the telephone industry in World War I and took over various factories. And so, yeah, that's how wars are financed. And taxes are the most direct and make the cost of war most explicit to the taxpayers, whereas inflation makes the cost of war the least visible to the taxpayers, and therefore the wars are more frequent and longer lasting when they occur if they are financed, the more they are financed by debt and inflation. There's a question from Helen. If U.S. income revenues continue to diminish, well, Helen, they haven't diminished. The government, if you're talking about tax revenue, the government is taking in more and more tax money every year and spending more money, and it's spending much more than it takes in. Could that stunt the ability to wage a total war? Well, I hope so, but unfortunately, this is not happening. Well, the Austrian School of Economics does not have a perspective about U.S. aggression toward Libya. I'm offering you my opinion based on sort of Rothbardian foreign policy analysis. But you can read some articles on lewrothwell.com. But Austrian economics per se has really nothing to say about this. That's a foreign policy question. And, of course, if you look at the facts of what happened in Libya, Gaddafi became an ally of the United States. He agreed to give up his nuclear program, and then once he disarmed himself, we overthrew him. Not we, but the U.S. government overthrew him and then murdered him. And then it created total chaos in the country of Libya. That's what happened. It has nothing to do with Austrian economics, but it has a lot to do with the conniving of the neoconservatives and their never-ending pursuit of creating instability and chaos in the Middle East. Let's see, Helen wants to know, is the U.S. the issuance of debt ultimately based on the collateral of income tax revenues? Yes, it is. That's why, for example, a lot of state governments that do not have very good economies can still have high bond ratings because they just have a good ability to tax the pants off their population and they have a big tax base. And so what the people who give out bond ratings are mostly interested in is the state government's ability to pay off the bond. And so a high bond rating doesn't necessarily of a state government doesn't necessarily mean that the state has a healthy economy compared to other states. And the same is true with countries. It's based on the ability of the government to plunder the taxpayers to pay off the bondholders. And Leslie's asking if the banks have an interest in keeping unemployment high with a voluntary army. Well, you know, that's probably an impossible question to answer, but, you know, the military is high-tech these days, so you don't need thousands of men to run across a desert to attack the enemy. You just need a drone to drop a 500-ton bomb on them. And so, you know, maybe 50 years ago, this would have been much more important to the banksters having high unemployment could have been. They might have seen that as being in their interest, but in today's world, you know, we've fought entire small wars. The Clinton's war in Bosnia was pretty much bombs being dropped from 10,000 feet in the air. Not a single American died in that. Let's see, a question about Brzezinski. Where does he admit this? There's no need for Brzezinski to admit anything. I mean, the Council on Foreign Relations is not some secret cabal of people who meet in the woods somewhere. You know, They have open meetings. They're written about in the New York Times. Zbigniew Brzezinski puts it on his resume. So this is not a secret. The CFR is not some secret organization. It's people put it on their resumes. And so it's not a matter of him lying about it and us having to dig it up to find out if Anthony Gregory is telling the truth about him being a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. It's easy to find out. He probably has his resume online somewhere. Everybody has a central government-run bank. Yeah, Travis is asking, does national socialism destroy economies similar to international socialism? Well, sure. The classic book is Socialism by Ludwig von Mises. And so if you want to know what, sort of getting off the point a little bit, but sort of socialism collapsed worldwide in the late 80s and early 90s, finally, and not that it ever created much of an economy of any kind, because a rational economic calculation is impossible. You can't calculate profits and losses, for example, in a world where there are no prices determined by supply and demand by consumers, because there's no private property under socialism. So for the same reason the German socialism was doomed to failure, Russian socialism and all socialism everywhere in the world has been tried, has been an utter failure. It doesn't matter whether you call it right wing or left wing. I feel like the question about the Marshall Plan. On the 50th anniversary of the Marshall Plan, I wrote an article that was published in the European Wall Street Journal. I think the title was The Marshall Plan Failed, or something along those lines. It was really based on, there was this old article written on the Marshall Plan in a book. And the author was Tyler Cowen, the George Mason University economist. And he wrote this, I think he wrote this article before he was even a professor. But it was a good analysis of the Marshall Plan. And it showed that the Marshall Plan money, well, first of all, was not sufficient to create economic revival of Germany. It was the deregulation of the German economy by Ludwig Erhard that created the so-called German miracle. And Tyler Cowen also showed that those countries that received the least Marshall Plan aid actually did the best in recovering in Europe. And also, the biggest recoveries occurred after the Marshall Plan aid was all gone, the program was over. And so it's a myth that Europe recovered after World War II because of the Marshall Plan. Now, it would be impossible to spend all that money without helping somebody, so somebody certainly was helped. But it was more the abandonment of fascism in Europe and socialism that created the recovery. And of course, the British adopted Fabian socialism after World War II. They kicked out Churchill, and the Labour Party came in, and they nationalized many of their main industries. And that led to, by the 70s, what was called the British disease, which is the disease of inefficiency of all socialist enterprises that did not operate on a profit and loss basis. And so, and that's what gave rise to the ability of Margaret Thatcher to become prime minister and privatize British steel, British coal, and other, all the so-called commanding heights of the British economy. Okay, here's Cam miraculously found this article by Tyler Cowen on the Marshall Plan. Yeah, I agree. Malcolm has a question. I agree with Rothbard that bankers and manufacturers are inherently statist in general. You can always find a few exceptions, but the exceptions prove the rule. For example, the CEO of BB&T Bank in the U.S., his name is John Allison. He's a Randian. He's a big fan of Ayn Rand and her writings. And he's, he's on economics, he's not a statist, but on foreign policy, he is. And so I wouldn't lump him in with everybody else. But I agree with Rothbard because investment banking in particular ties investment banking to the state. And so you have to be a statist to succeed in investment banking. Let's see, the Bismarck lay a foundation for World War I with tactics. I'm not sure what tactics are being referred to, so I don't think I can answer that question. One of the things Bismarck did, though, was he consolidated a lot of power in the central government in Germany by essentially neutering the states and their powers. In fact, Adolf Hitler, in his famous book Mein Kampf, praises Bismarck to the treetops for doing just that, for essentially abolishing states' rights for federalism in Germany. And so Hitler didn't have much work to do. When he became Chancellor of Germany, Germany was already a very highly centralized state thanks to what Bismarck had done. And so the Nazis were able to take control over this highly centralized state and turn it into what they turned it into. Had Bismarck not done that, it would have been much more difficult. There would have been a lot of political opposition out of the provinces, so to speak, in Germany and elsewhere in Europe, for that matter, if other parts of Europe had remained decentralized. But that's one thing that Bismarck did that turned out to be a very bad thing. Hitler was a fan of Lincoln. In Mein Kampf, he quotes, paraphrases Abe Lincoln's first inaugural address in order to make his case, Hitler's case, for the abolition of states' rights in Germany. I have an old article from LewRockwell.com entitled Jaffa's Hitlerian Defense of Lincoln that quotes chapter and verse from Mein Kampf of Hitler praising Lincoln to the treetops. Malcolm has a question about the Progressive Party. I would refer you again to the book Bully Boy by Jim Powell. He discusses all of this in quite a bit of detail. So that's where I would look. Let's see, Malcolm also had a question up here about industries that are inherently statist. Well, the steel industry has always been protected. The steel industry made the infant industry argument for protectionism as soon as there was a steel industry. And then fast forward 175 years to the Bush administration, Bush II, and the first thing President Bush did, one of the first things, was to impose 35% tariffs on steel. And so they're still being protected. And so I would call that an inherently statist business. Let's see if I can find any others here. Let's see. Helen has a question that Hayek talks about how the worst gets to the top. That's true. It's probably the most famous chapter of The Road to Serfdom by Hayek about how the worst gets to the top. One of the themes of The Road to Serfdom, though, is that Hayek says he's not predicting that it's inevitable that the Western democracies that have adopted collectivism will have another Hitler. It's all a matter of, the so-called liberals in America are really communists in slow motion. They seem to embrace all the things that communists embraced in Europe, in terms of, you know, whether you call them communists or socialists or whatever, but they're not willing to become revolutionaries and impose it on the rest of society with mass violence like the Russian revolutionaries were. But I don't think it's inevitable that socialism and fiat money will produce someone like Hitler, no one could predict. And that's not what Hayek was saying either when he gave his warnings in the Road to Serfdom. Let's see, other questions? I'm looking for Q&A here. Okay, we seem to be running out of gas, which is totally fine. Okay. Well, I guess it's time to call it a night then. We seem to have run out of Q&A here, I think. Yeah, pretty much. Okay, well, then thanks everyone for participating again, and have a good night. And I hope you all learned something from the class and the readings. And we'll have fun next week bemoaning the current dilemma that we're in, thanks to the current generation of banksters.